Today's episode is sponsored by the Star Trek Starships Collection, the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios. Featuring vessels from the 50 years of Star Trek, each is expertly sculpted, hand-painted, and comes with an authoritative collector's magazine. Start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D for only $4.95 with free shipping. For details and to order, visit st-starships.com/random. That's st-starships.com/random. Thank you to the Star Trek Starships Collection for sponsoring Random Trek. Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My guest tonight is Carolyn Sita. Carolyn, thank you for joining me.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here.
I think I said your name wrong, didn't I? I said Carolyn instead of Caroline.
Yeah, but, you know, that's it. Established. Really, whatever. I threw you off with my lengthy monologue about it.
No, that's fine. And this is staying in the episode. So, now that I've got your name right... Let's talk a little bit about Star Trek, which also I often get things wrong. People are very upset about me when I'll tell you, I've told this story so many times, but we had an episode of Voyager that we were watching, and Chakotay, character in Voyager, not my favorite character in Voyager, but he's a character in Voyager. For some reason, throughout the entire episode, I called him Chipotle.
Oh, sure. A little, like, subtle product placement on your part.
I wish Chipotle had paid for that, but it was just me being stupid. So, anyway, Caroline, tell the people a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, so I am a pop culture writer. You can find me at places like the AV Club and Quartz and sometimes Boing Boing. I also co-host a podcast called Debating Doctor Who, which is mostly about Doctor Who, although surprisingly, we end up talking about Star Trek quite a bit. So yeah, that's kind of me.
Ooh, now if you had to pick, I've had many people in the Doctor Who fandom on this Star Trek podcast. If you had to pick between Doctor Who and Star Trek, I don't know why you would have to, other than in this hypothetical situation in which I'm creating, which would you pick?
I promise I'm not just trying to get your audience on my side, but without question, I would pick Star Trek. I love Doctor Who. But it's a different kind of love than the love I feel for Star Trek.
Let's explore your love. And, so what makes your love for Star Trek different than your love for Doctor Who?
Well, so I came to Doctor Who pretty late, like within the past, I don't know, maybe 5 years or something. Star Trek, I like was quite literally raised on. I grew up in the Next Generation era. And I mean, pretty much since I was an infant, my parents were watching. My dad especially is a big Trekkie. And so, like, all of my earliest childhood memories are just of the Next Generation. I feel like Picard and Riker are, like, my pseudo father figures in addition to my real father. So, yeah, it was just sort of, like, always around when I was a kid. I couldn't wrap my mouth around the word Star Trek, so I called it Man-Man for some reason that no one is really sure of. So, yeah, so really, like, literally a lifelong Star Trek fan.
Well, I think you called it Man-Man because you imprinted heavily on Picard and Riker. Those are the two men.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Those were the two key men in my television watching.
Exactly. See, look, we're finding out so much about you.
Yeah, good psychoanalysis.
It's a service I provide in addition to just talking about Star Trek. That's interesting because, you know, there is this theory that people who find things later in life and convert to, well, particularly religions, but science fiction fandom can be a bit religious, are the most zealous of people. So one might think that since you came to Doctor Who late, that you might be just crazy about Doctor Who in a good way, and that would overshadow your Star Trek fandom.
It's true, yeah. Maybe there was a little bit right when I was getting into it where it did, but I think that the Star Trek, it never quite burned as bright, but it was like a simmer has lasted longer, perhaps.
It's smoldering.
Yeah, exactly.
Like Commander Riker's looks.
Exactly.
Although I don't know if he's really has smoldering looks, but I suppose in some episodes he does.
Yeah.
As long as he has a beard. Nobody likes beardless Riker. Sorry, Jonathan Frakes. So... I'm going to ask you a Doctor Who question, and then we can get back to Star Trek.
Great.
Your favorite Doctor?
My favorite Doctor is the 10th Doctor, David Tennant.
Ah, yes.
Although I like them all, I'm pretty even keeled about that. But he's a little bit above the rest for me.
I think that I would echo your choice. I liked so I did not watch much Doctor Who. My friend in college tried to get me to watch Doctor Who, but this was, you know, before the reboots, and so he was trying to get me to watch the old Doctor Who, and I just could not get into it because it's just.
It's hard, man. I haven't actually delved that much into it. My podcast co-host is big on the classic Who, whereas I'm more of the new Who fan. And it's just a very different, like, pacing, which honestly is how I feel a little bit about Star Trek as well. Like, as much as I love, and I deeply love the original series, but it just feels like its own thing. Like, I'm never going to be like, am I in the mood for a next-gen episode or an original series episode? Like, they're two very separate things in my mind that are very different, although I enjoy them both.
Yes, and I think even – so the original series, very slowly paced because, you know, it's 50 years old. That's just the way it was. Doctor Who, like some old Doctor Who, are even older than that, and so they are even more slowly paced. There's a lot of corridors and a lot of walking around, and you consider what's happening, and a lot of long shots of nothing. And plus, let's be honest here. I mean, this is part of the Doctor Who – kind of the trappings of Doctor Who now, right? It's kind of a cliche, but in classic Who, horrible special effects.
Yeah, really bad. Honestly, they make original series look like it is a contemporary masterpiece compared to the stuff that they tried to get away with on classic Who.
Yes, and that's why I just couldn't get into it. But I do like the reboot, and so I think for my if I had to pick a second favorite Doctor, because I do think David Tennant was the best one, I would pick Christopher Eccleston.
He's really good too. He only had one season to really establish himself, but he made a really big impact for sure.
Yes, he established it, and then he was like, "I don't want to be known as Doctor Who forever. I'm out of here. See you later." Which brings, you know, the fabulous thing about Doctor Who, right, is three generations, so you can have as many actors play that as you want. But now we'll end our Doctor Who segments because people want us to talk about Star Trek, I'm sure. I'm going to guess I know the answer to this based on our discussion of your childhood, but if you had to pick your favorite Star Trek show, which would you pick?
Well, this is interesting because I think I'm going to throw you off a little bit here, because I would say by far Deep Space Nine is my favorite Star Trek show. And maybe this goes back to your theory too about coming to things later, because I didn't watch DS9 too much when I was a kid because I was a little too young to like understand the continuity of it and keep everything sort through all that. And I actually did end up like just sitting down and marathoning all of DS9 for the first time in college. And that was when I really fell in love with it. So to me, it's just, I used to waffle back and forth like, DS9 and Next Gen are both really good, and they are, don't get me wrong, but I just think DS9 is the best thing that Star Trek ever did, like sort of by a country mile.
I agree with you, and people who listen to this podcast know that, so I'm not going to go into my reasons why I agree with you, because people are sick of hearing me sing the praises of Deep Space Nine, and if you're listening to this and you haven't watched all of Deep Space Nine, yes, the first couple of seasons are rocky, I know that. But once you get past it, Star Trek Gold, I'm telling you.
It's
Star
just Trek so good. Gold. I also am a pretty big Voyager defender. I'm not going to say it's the best show, but I think it gets a little bit unfairly maligned by the fandom. So I'm always eager to defend Voyager.
I will say that before I started this podcast, I did not like Voyager. Luckily for Voyager, I mean, not that anyone cares, right? But Enterprise came along, so I like Enterprise even less than I like Voyager. So
yeah. When people say that Enterprise is better than Voyager, I get very suspicious, because I'm like, I'm not sure you've watched these shows all the way through, and this is a real opinion to be had.
I don't know who could actually say that with a straight face. And also, you know, for people who are angry, Enterprise defenders out there, yes, it's fourth season of Enterprise is very good, but sadly, the first three seasons, not all that good. But Voyager, I gave it a short shrift, and now I think that it is pretty good. I like it. They have some very good episodes, some excellent episodes, not even just very good episodes, excellent episodes. Some of my favorite Star Trek episodes are from Voyager, but overall,
there's good stuff in there.
I think the problem with Voyager is that it has also my least favorite characters are on Voyager, so it makes it difficult.
Yeah. There's some good ones there, too, though. I think there's a couple. There's definitely some bland people, but I think, like, B'Elanna Torres, she should be higher up in the Star Trek canon than she is. Seven mm-hmm. of Nine's amazing. The Doctor's amazing. Mm-hmm. I really like Tuvok. I think that Tuvok needs to be praised more. I think that's a really good depiction of a Vulcan that Tim Russ does, more so than like T'Pol and Enterprise, I think, doesn't quite get it, but Tim Russ, he deserves more praise.
I agree. I think Tim Russ is one of my favorite characters. Well, Tim Russ is a person. Tuvok is one of my favorite characters. I don't know Tim Russ. I'm sure he's a lovely man. I did see him once on an episode of, I don't remember, like Castle or something. And I thought, it's Tuvok. Tuvok can't be a murderer. But Tim Russ needs to make some money, so I understand.
Yeah.
But on the other side, though, you've got Neelix. Ugh, Neelix.
Yeah, okay.
And you've not got so Kes and Neelix
really
together.
Not good. I'm
super
not a
creepy.
Kes fan.
No, Harry Kim. People know I hate Harry Kim.
Yeah, fair.
So Tom Paris. I don't really like Tom Paris all that much.
He toes the line for me. I can find him kind of charming in a really nerdy way. I can't like say he's an amazing character, but he doesn't like offend me in the way that like Kes just annoys me when she's on screen.
Yeah. Oh, Kes. I'm glad they got rid of her. Fairly quickly. And I, my only regret with that is that she did not take Neelix with her.
Yeah.
Come Neelix, let's go. But we're not here to talk about Voyager. Although I like Captain Janeway as well. So she's a thumbs up Captain Janeway. We're here to talk about Deep Space Nine, specifically, season 5, episode 23, Blaze of Glory, which, spoiler alert, refers to, the death of, a character. And you don't really see many characters in Star Trek that die.
That's a good point. Yeah, certainly not ones that are in multiple episodes. Maybe like a random one-off guest star. But yeah, I guess this is a kind of a big deal episode.
Yeah, so I mean, well, it's Michael Eddington who dies. All you Michael Eddington fans out there, sorry. And people who haven't watched this episode, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast if you haven't seen the episode. But spoiler alert, Michael Eddington dies at the end. And I'm trying to think of the other people who have, obviously Spock has died, but that was in a movie and he didn't really die. All kinds of spoiler alerts, by the way.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess the big one for DS9 is Dax, kind of, sort of, half dies, half Dax. Gets to live on in a,
yes,
in a new Jadzia,
body. I guess, dies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then we get Ezri, which, you know, I like a lot about Deep Space Nine. I would say I like 99% of Deep Space Nine. I have a problem with Ezri, and I think it is mostly because she had a tough act to follow.
Yeah, for sure. And it's just like an awkward, it's one thing like when you switch out the Kes and Seven of Nine and you sort of have equal time with both, but it's hard to switch somebody out for one season. That's not going to make anybody look good, really.
Yeah, she had a tough job, so it's not all her fault. And actually, it's probably not the fault of the actor at all. So I don't even know who played her, but you did a fine job, I'm sure. the other character I didn't like in the early seasons of Deep Space Nine, although he grew on me, mostly because of his relationship with Garak and Chief O'Brien, is Dr. Bashir.
Interesting. I'm a big Bashir fan, which might be more how he looks than, I guess, his personality, too. I've always had a big crush on Bashir. I think he's very sweet. But again, sort of like Paris, like I can see the weaknesses of the character, but I think overall I find him charming and pretty unoffensive.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he doesn't offend me. he's no Neelix, but of the cast of characters, if I had to rank them all in Deep Space Nine, he would be, I believe, on the bottom of the list, even below Ezri, because she was not on very long, so I
can't. Wow, that's pretty low, though.
Well,
that's interesting.
I'm a tough critic. I'm a harsh,
yeah,
harsh
fair,
critic.
Fair.
But that being said, you know, people get upset when I say bad things about Star Trek. I still like him as a character. I still like Star Trek. It's all great.
Don't worry, fans. I will defend him for you.
But let's talk about the other characters before we jump into this episode, and talk about, well, let's talk about your favorite character on Deep Space Nine. I don't know who he is, or she, or it. But you're going to tell me, and then we'll talk about it.
I would say probably Kira. She's probably up there just in general across the whole Star Trek canon. She's super great. I love that she's really tough, and she's got this rebellious, fiery side, but they also let her be really religious and spiritual and sort of empathetic. And I just think it's cool, really, for any character to be like that, but specifically, I think, like a female character, which Star Trek has not always had the most amazing track record with, but I think with Kira, they got it really spot on.
I agree. I think Kira is one of the best characters in Star Trek, period. And I think you can say that a lot of characters on Deep Space Nine, I feel like, are among the best characters in Star Trek, mostly because Deep Space Nine was the first Star Trek series that really delved into arcs and developed characters. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as I love the original series, there's none of that because that was, you know, 50 years ago. You didn't do that in the 60s. So, and I love, you know, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, yes, the Holy Trinity. Great characters. And the Next Generation, also not much character development. Mm-hmm. From, you know, you watch the first episode, you watch the last episode, and you feel like you have a relationship with these characters if you watch the whole seven seasons. But from the beginning to the end, they're pretty much the same characters. But you cannot say that for Deep Space Nine, which I think makes it so much more interesting and makes the characters so much richer. Even Julian Bashir.
Yeah.
Because he has quite an arc, right? We find out he...
He actually does. He has... You could call it an arc. You could call it a retcon. But yeah, either way, there's definitely some stuff for him to dig into.
Yes, we won't spoil that.
But no, I think he does have a big arc from his little... I don't know. He's very naive at the beginning. And I think he's a little bit more sort of mature by the end of the run.
Yes, and then his relationship with Jadzia becomes mm-hmm. interesting as opposed to creepy. And I really do like him, his relationship with Garak and with Chief O'Brien.
Yeah, I think both of those are amazing.
Those episodes with them are fantastic. Although Garak is not in this episode, I don't think Chief O'Brien appears, does he?
In one scene, I just remember because they were talking about the Badlands, and he called them the Badlands with his little accent, and I thought it was so cute, but I think he literally had, like, one line, and that was it. It was to mispronounce Badlands.
And then off you go.
Yeah.
Our thanks to Casper for sponsoring Random Trek. Now, Casper is a sleep brand that creates one perfect mattress. It's sold directly to customers, eliminating commission-driven inflated prices. Its award-winning sleep surface, I don't know what awards it won, but many of them, I assume, was developed in-house and has a sleek design and is delivered in a small, how did they do that, size box. I've seen these boxes. They're small. The mattresses are normal size. In addition to the mattress, Casper also offers an adaptive pillow and soft, breathable sheets. Now, Casper is high quality. They've got an in-house team of engineers that have spent thousands of hours developing the Casper, and it combines springy latex and supportive memory foam for a sleep surface that's got just the right sink and just the right bounce. Plus, its breathable design sleeps cool to help you regulate your temperature through the night. I'm a hot sleeper. I appreciate this. Now, these mattresses are, I know what you're thinking, they must cost an arm and a leg, because mattresses can often cost over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost $500 for a twin-size mattress, $600 for a twin XL, $750 for a full, $850 for a queen, and $950 for a king. The best part about buying Casper mattress, friends, is it's completely risk-free, free delivery, free returns, and is a 100-night home trial. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up, refund you everything. You've got no risk involved. So if this has intrigued you, you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting www.casper.com/trek and using the offer code TREK. Terms and conditions apply. Once again, thanks to Casper for supporting Random Trek. Worf is Worf in this? I guess he is.
Yeah, he and Dax like come back and they're up. Like, oh, it's cloaked, but they know where our ship is. Again, it was like all right. These, like, everyone has one line, so you get a paycheck and then you get to leave for the rest of the episode.
That's right. Because this episode is really about, there's an A plot and a B plot. The A plot's pretty heavy, so the B plot has to be super light, which is what we get in this, right? So this is a Sisko episode, which is always exciting because I really like Sisko, especially. You know when it's going to be good when you have a bald goatee, yeah. Sisko. If there is no goatee and he has hair, it may be good, but it might not be good.
Yeah, no guarantees.
But then the RB plot focuses on Jake Sisko, who I could do without.
I have a really big soft spot for kids on Trek. I think that they get made fun of a lot. Even, you know, Wesley. Like, to me, they're all fine. Like, I'm not going to pick them at the top of my list, but they don't like, irk me the way that they irk some people. I think Jake can be, like, a little, like, oh, golly gee, but I think it's kind of sweet.
In defense of, even though I'm the one that said something bad about Jake, in the defense of Jake, also, he becomes much more interesting as the series comes along. So, and that may have to do with the fact that, you know, it's hard being a kid actor, mm-hmm. and he was pretty young when they started, so one assumes as he grew older and he was getting influenced by all the other actors, he became a better actor, and they actually gave him stuff to do, right? Because a lot of the time, it was just, oh, Jake, you need to do your homework.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, we don't really need to see this, but we do need to see it, right? Because they're humanizing Captain Sisko, mm-hmm. so it all makes sense. And Nog. So Jake and Nog. This is another instance of where I like Jake is fine, but when you put mm-hmm. Jake and Nog together, I like them a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. They're a great little duo, and they don't ever quite get the same focus as Bashir and O'Brien do, but I think it's a similar sort of very sweet friendship. And I'm always happy to see them pop up together.
Yes. So this is we've got Nog. This is Cadet Nog. So he's gone to Starfleet Academy and he's back trying to earn his pips or something. I don't really know how it works, but he's doing whatever cadets do.
His intern year.
That's right. Which I guess in this case is he's working security. And he's not really enjoying it, as we find out in the opening, where he, Jake, and Sisko are having a delicious meal of squids in tube grub puree, apparently.
Delicious. Which... I liked that little opening scene. I thought that was sweet. I like the dynamic of, like, on the one hand, oh, it's a dad and a son and the son's best friend. But on the other hand, it's like a commander or a captain and the person that works under him. And they kind of weave all that together and acknowledge the sort of awkwardness. I thought that was very sweet.
Yes, and I think it's amazing. I think it speaks to the actor's prowess, right? That what you can tell, like, before Jake brings up any of Nong's like unhappiness with security, they're just kind of hanging out, and it's their relationship before Nog was a cadet. But once Sisko hears, oh, there's something wrong.
Yeah,
it's suddenly he's Captain Sisko, and it's Cadet Nog, and Jake is just kind of like, tell him, Nog. And Nog's like, shut up. Yeah, and Jake
doesn't quite understand why maybe that was not the most appropriate thing to bring up at dinner.
Yes, Jake does. It seems a little clueless. He's just trying to help. He doesn't understand that the relationship has changed, I think, which is understandable. He's a civilian, and his dad has always been a Starfleet officer. So, and Nog, he always, Josh's Nog. So,
yeah.
And I did also find it funny when, Sisko was like, oh, yes, this Nog is like, this sauce tastes familiar. And that's when we find out it's tube grubs, and Jake is disgusted.
I thought that spoke well to Sisko, that he was really chill about using the tube grubs. I would have had a reaction like Jake. I don't think I would have been so into that. But I was like, oh, Sisko, look at you. Like, you're really open to other cultures in this good situation. For you. Yeah.
Yes,
cooking with tube grubs.
My wife sneaks in things into, not tube grubs, but. I don't like mushrooms, so she tries to sneak puree mushrooms into many things. And then after, days after we've eaten something, she's like, hey, remember those lettuce wraps we had? And I was like, oh, yeah, they're delicious. She said, they had mushrooms in them. Like, oh, tube grubs.
Yeah, I guess it works pretty well if you didn't taste them. Really, Sisko's only mistake was telling Jake about it.
Yes, never tell. That's my thing. I will eat anything as long as I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Once I know that it's something disgusting, I have no interest in eating it afterwards. But if you just gave me a plate of puree, I would eat it.
Yeah, exactly.
But so that's is an interesting beginning scene, and that's where it sets up this B plot, where Nog is not getting the respect from the Klingons he deserves or he feels he deserves, and Sisko basically says you have to earn the respect, you can't just expect it. So stare them down, don't let them ignore you, and they will respect you. And that's when Jake says, "Well, they'll either respect you or beat you up. Either way."
I like Jake's general sort of. He seems to find every, like, this is a pretty high stakes situation for Nog, but Jake really just finds it all hilarious, like, pretty consistently. It's like, it would be really funny if those Klingons punched you and you lost your job. And I kind of like how detached he is from everything.
I know, because this is super important for Nog. He's the first Ferengi who has ever gone to Starfleet. He doesn't want to screw it up. He's stationed on where he lives, so his whole family would be very sad if he got kicked out. These are high stakes. And yeah, Jake is just like, boy, oh boy, I hope you don't get beaten up by Klingons.
Klingons who were just banging their heads together.
As Klingons do.
Out on the promenade. I was like, oh, okay, this is a little, sometimes I think that they kind of dumb down the Klingons when they need them to be dumb. And I was like, this might be a step too far.
That's true. Well, let's clear up the B plot, because it really doesn't have any impact on the A plot. And then we'll get to the A plot. They don't really intersect.
Yeah, they really don't.
No. I mean, the only thing, so Martok appears and he tells Sisko, oh, we found this Maquis transmission. And Sisko's like, the Maquis have been destroyed. How could they transmit something? And we find out, oh no, this was a transmission for Michael Eddington, and there are a bunch of cloaked missiles heading towards Cardassia, which is bad news because the Cardassians are in league with the Dominion, and if they think humans have attacked them, that will start the war that we know starts anyway, but they don't want it to start now. And so that's the A plot, the big high stakes A plot. The B plot is nobody respects Nog. specifically Klingons, I suppose, do not respect Nog. Everybody else, I guess, seems pretty chill with Nog. And I do like that so Jake and Nog are in Quarks, and the Klingons are headbutting each other for no apparent reason. And I love how Nog, this isn't something they make a big deal out of, but Nog knows exactly the decibels that they mm-hmm. are making without any kind of instrument, just because he's a Ferengi and he has very mm-hmm. sensitive ears. And I just thought that's a great little detail. He's like, that's 65 decibels, 5 decibels more, and I can give them a citation.
Yeah, I like that too. I think they might come back to that in later seasons too. Like, that's his one little special skill. But it's a nice little, I don't know, it's a nice little nod of like, oh yeah, this is why it's good to have a diverse Federation or a diverse Starfleet, because you really do have sort of different skill sets that can all be utilized in different ways.
Exactly. And then they underwrite that, of course, by Nog falling over yeah. in his chair when he's about to tell the Klingons to beat it up, to cut it out. And there's a nice little scene where Jake is like, oh, are you gonna, you know, walk over to them? And Nog is like, no, tell me when they leave. Actually, he yeah. says, tell me when everyone leaves. And Jake is like, why? And he says, I'm not getting up until everyone leaves. Which, you know, I can understand you are, it's his first job, right? His first real career, right? And he wants to be good at it and impress everybody, and he doesn't want to look ridiculous. And he's so small.
I know, he really is. I mostly liked this plot. Like, it's really light. I almost wish it had been, a little more serious, because it is kind of, like we were saying, like a pretty high-stakes situation. It's a weird, like, are they prejudiced against Ferengis? Is this sort of like a bigger societal issue? I thought Nog learning to stand up for himself was very sweet, and I almost wish, I don't know, there had been more of it or less of it. It was a weird sort of in between, and then we get that yeah. scene where, I don't know, it feels like they kind of needed filler, because there was that scene where Quark is injured because he and Worm yeah. got into a fight, and this felt like, oh, they needed to fill the episode, but then why didn't they fill it with more Nog things? I kind of liked it all, but it was oddly structured to me.
Yeah. And I think that Quark scene has they never do anything about it. It yeah. has no meaning. I mean, they mentioned that Morn was naked, which is an image I don't need. but it was weird. Because you think, well, they're going to come back to it at some
yeah.
point.
Yeah, or it'll intersect with the Nog thing. Yeah, it was really just like we needed Quark to have right. a scene, so we'll give him a funny. And I guess Bashir. They were just trying to fit everyone into this episode, I think, is all they were doing.
But it would have been interesting, I think, you're right, because it is unclear whether the Ferengi are the Klingons are ignoring Nog because he's a Ferengi or because he is so small. Which, for either one, you could make a plausible reason, because the Klingons are large generally. Yeah. And so and Nog, the actor who plays Nog, I mean, he's a small guy. So yeah. And it is very, you know, there are lots of angles, shots that make it, you know, mm-hmm. emphasize the height difference between him and the Klingons. And then I kind of felt like it was a Ferengi thing, that they just don't respect Ferengis, but they don't really discuss that. So I don't know if that's just me projecting. But it would have been.
I sort of felt that way too. And then it was very unclear by the end.
Yeah, and I think they would have been better using that scene with Quark, with, you know, Nog talking to Quark about, hey, nobody would respect me, and then Quark could have said, yeah, they're, you know, typical Klingons, they don't mm-hmm. respect Ferengi or something like that, and here's what you do, you buy their land or their ancestral yeah. land or something, or whatever ridiculous advice Quark would give somebody, but they don't have that scene, so.
I did like the scene where he eventually gets Martog's respect, and he yes. kind of stands up to him, and you're not sure if he's going to punch him, and he starts laughing. I thought that was good. I always really enjoy Martog, so it was nice to see him here.
Yeah, Smartug is one of my favorite Klingons. Thumbs up to him. And yeah, he Nog is like, you guys are loitering. You have to get moving. And Martok is like, I will decide when we will move. And Nog is like, well, you got to move. Station regulations. And Martok is like, you are either very stupid or very brave. And Nog says, probably a little of both. And he wins the respect of Martok. And then we have a later scene where Nog finds Kira's ear cuff.
Yeah.
In a random Jeffrey's tube or something, and Martok comes off of the escalator, or not the escalator, the turbo lift. It would have been less impactful if it was an escalator.
Just a Klingon's cruising down the escalator.
That's right. And he says, you know, cadet, and Nog acknowledges him and cares like, what was that about? And it was about respect. And so that's a nice, the B plot, cute, could have been a little more interesting, but overall, well done. The A plot is where we don't have, we spent so much time talking about the B plot, but the A plot is fairly straightforward, but very interesting. So we know that these missiles are headed towards Cardassia. We know the Klingons gave the Maquis cloaking devices, so these missiles are cloaked. They can't be detected. Worf and Dax were off in the Badlands trying to find it. They can't find them. So Sisko has to go to Michael Eddington and say, you gotta help me, man. Because you don't want the war to be on your head, I guess, basically. And we find that Michael Eddington is being stored on the space station from Star Trek II.
Very odd establishing shot there.
Yes. And it is literally the same shot from Star Trek II. And he's in the brig, and they have this... I feel like there are a lot of very good scenes between Eddington and Sisko, because they just don't... You feel like they're two sides of the same coin, right? They both are very dedicated and believe in the mission of the organization they're trying to fight for. And Sisko feels kind of, well, he thinks that Eddington is a traitor because he deserted the Federation, or Starfleet in particular, and joined the Maquis, who are terrorists, right? So Sisko, not a big fan of that. And Eddington accuses Sisko of not only caring because Sisko wants to be an admiral, and that's why he wants to do all this stuff, because he doesn't really care about anything other than his career advancement, which I never really got from Sisko, so I don't know what Eddington is basing that on.
Sisko makes stronger points than Eddington does. I think they were trying to set them up as equals, but they couldn't quite hit Sisko's weaknesses as like strongly as they could Eddington's. But yeah, I think he's at least trying to goad him in some way. Some of it I was like, yeah, that sounds right. And other times I was like, oh, that's not. You're misinterpreting Sisko here.
What's wrong with you, Eddington?
Yeah.
And I mean, it's fairly straightforward until the very end where we get the twist, which I thought was interesting. But we could talk about others. So he basically, Eddington's like, I don't want to help you. I don't care. I'm a prisoner, so I'm going to do what prisoners do, which is just lay in this bed. And Sisko's like, well, the Dominion is going to come and blow the space station up. And he's like, I'm just going to wait for that to happen. I don't give a crap. And Sisko's like, I don't get you. And then we cut to the B plot, and we never really find out how Sisko. Well, I guess Sisko basically says, I don't care. You're not volunteering. You're a prisoner. I'm taking you on my little ship, and we're going to the Badlands. And so that's what happens. And this is where we find out that Eddington has turned into a foodie.
And yeah, a lot of discussion of food, replicator food versus homegrown food, I guess. They gave them really unattractive looking replicator food props. I was like, that doesn't usually look this bad. They really had to like hammer home the concept that replicator food isn't good.
And I find that suspicious based on what I know of this fake technology replicators, because from what I understand, I could be wrong. I don't have the Starfleet technical manual next to me, but basically the replicator turns energy into matter. So it should be exactly whatever you want it to be. But Eddington is like, oh, this is just, you know, what replicated protein and carbohydrate strings strung together. So it doesn't taste anything like regular food, which I find hard to believe. Hey, you, did you know that it's the 50th anniversary of Star Trek? That's right, 50 years of Star Trek. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate than heading down to New York City or up or over, depending on where you are right now, and visiting the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum. Why would you go there? Well, it's awesome, but also they are the first venue in the United States to host Star Trek, the Starfleet Academy experience. You could channel your inner Spock or your inner Kirk, channel your inner Uhura, and become a cadet and embark on a 12,000 square foot interactive journey. This exhibit is basically your Starfleet entrance exam. You'll go through it. There are different points. There are 9 areas that you can visit that focus on language, medicine, engineering, navigation, command, and science. Once you've completed this, you get a commissioning post, a little certificate. It's fantastic. And then you can go explore the rest of the exhibit, which has original costumes and props from the Star Trek series and the movies. Plus, The museum has the shuttlecraft Galileo from the original series on display, which you may know best as the hallmark ornament that you press. And Spock says, "Shuttlecraft Enterprise, Shuttlecraft Enterprise, Spock here, happy holidays." But that ornament is not there. The original shuttlecraft is there. The exhibit is open now for a limited engagement now through October 31st, 2016. Make sure you don't miss it. Best of all, you get $5 off if you use the promo code Trekkie. That's T-R-E-K-K-I-E. That offer is good for up to 4 full-priced adult, child, or senior Star Trek tickets only. Use the promo code Trekkie online or at the box office to receive the discount. Sadly, you cannot combine it with any other offer. Plus, for Star Trek fans, young and old, you can now have a Star Trek overnight experience. Visit Star Trek After Hours. You can watch Star Trek movies under the stars, see the Galileo shuttlecraft, visit the Space Shuttle Enterprise, which is a real space shuttle, and everyone gets to take home a swag bag with Star Trek and Intrepid souvenirs. Sounds like fun to me. You can find out more info at intrepidmuseum.org/StarTrekNights. If you don't know where the Intrepid Museum is, it's located on Pier 86, West 46th Street and 12th Avenue in New York City. If you want to buy tickets, which I think you should, visit intrepidmuseum.org/StarTrek and you'll find tickets and information there. Don't forget to use the promo code Trekkie. Boldly go to the Intrepid Museum and experience the Starfleet Academy experience.
Yeah, I kind of bought it as a, oh, okay, this is a establishing trait for the Maquis. I think it sort of ties in actually to how I feel about the Maquis in general, which is that they're such a great concept, mm-hmm. but in execution, there's something about them that never quite clicks into place. Like, they never quite feel like a real sort of group of people to me, and they never quite assemble the right quirks. And I think this was the writer sort of being like, oh yeah, one of, you know, here's an idea about the Maquis. They really like homegrown foods and they don't, you know, they don't want to use replicators. And it's a cool idea, but it never quite, for some reason, like, it never quite clicks into me, unless, you know, it does on an intellectual level, but there's something about the execution that's just like 90% good and 10% off, and it doesn't quite work.
That's because I'm like, I totally want a replicator. I don't know what you're talking about.
This is the most amazing technology.
Exactly. You go on and on about how hard it is to grow tomatoes, and yet you are poo-pooing the replicators.
Yeah.
And I think tomatoes are one of the easier things to grow, but I'm not a gardener, so I could be wrong about that. But I know all of my friends who have tomatoes and they grow them in their gardens seem to have huge amounts of tomatoes, which leads me to believe they're not super hard to grow. But maybe they're hard to grow on some Cardassian planet that you're colonizing and you shouldn't be there. Yeah. And so with Cardassians shooting at you, it's harder to grow your tomatoes.
Yeah, that's fair.
And also, they would be an invasive species, so really you shouldn't be growing tomatoes on that planet anyway, Michael Eddington. But I'm probably low on the list of things that the Maquis, laws the Maquis have broken. Importing invasive species onto their planets. And that's the thing, right? The Maquis are upset because the Cardassians and Starfleet have come up with a treaty where some of the planets that the Maquis had settled on are actually Cardassian planets, and they don't want to leave their planets, so they get upset. But they were wiped out, except for, well, we think they're wiped out, except for Michael Eddington. He's the last Maquis standing, and he's the only man who can tell us where the launch pad for these missiles is, which is apparently the only place that you can transmit the code that will turn them off, which seems like a stretch to me, but you gotta, there's a whole point for this episode. You gotta get those characters there somehow. So there are some good scenes, and the best scene on the runabout is when so Michael Eddington is like, I'd rather die than help you, Sisko, but I'll only help you because I think I'll be able to kill you at the end of this for some reason. And then Sisko, the Dominion ships appear, and Sisko's like, those are your Dominion ships, are getting really close. And Eddington's like, I don't care, it seems like a problem for you. And Sisko's like, I'm going to get some Reactogeno. I think maybe you can handle this. And Eddington, that causes Eddington, you know, they play a little game of chicken. Eddington blinks first, he leaps up and pilots them seemingly out of trouble. But then we find out that the Dominion have somehow tracked them, and now the shoe's on the other foot, and he makes Sisko do something that looks really simple, but is apparently
really
super
simple.
Complicated.
A lot of pulling cables from one hole and putting them in another hole.
Yes. Sisko's like, this is super hard, and if I have any
so
distractions,
dangerous. Yeah.
Yes, we will all die. And he takes like 4 tubes and moves them to like 3 inches, but whatever. They have to do that, and then they escape the Dominion. They find the secret planet with the launchers. They land, they find out, oh no, Dominion soldiers have killed everybody. and Sisko and Eddington have to band together to fight the Dominion soldiers. They do that, and we find out that there are people that are still alive, and there were, in fact, no missiles, and Michael Eddington had used this as an elaborate ruse to get his people off this planet, because this was their fallback point.
And not just the people, it was his wife, too.
Oh, that's right, I forget her. So they don't give that a lot of time to really settle in.
They really don't give that any time.
It would have been much more poignant had we had a couple more scenes with the wife, but it's basically, oh, look, this is my wife. And Sisko is like, I didn't know you were married. And Eddington's like, yep, totally married. I gotta go die now. And
yeah, it was, I guess this is, and I mean, this is the same thing I said about the Maquis, right? Like, I love this in concept, and I love so much of this episode in concept, and a lot of the scenes I really love too, but again, there's something that just doesn't quite click for me. I think I'm not the biggest fan of Eddington, of that actor's performance, of Kenneth Marshall's performance. There's something about the wife stuff that doesn't quite work for me. There's something about, I mean, it's a cool twist. Oh, the missiles weren't real this whole time. But mm-hmm. I think then in retrospect, it kind of makes Eddington a very confusing character because, like, I get he was trying to go along with this missile story to get Sisko to take him. But he put up a big fight for what was ultimately not in his interest. Like, it's one thing to be like, oh, I'm pretending to be hesitant. But it's another to get to the point where you might not be able to go on this mission that is super important to you. And also his whole thing at the end was, oh, I have nothing to live for. Most of the Maquis are dead. Our cause is dead, so I'll just die now. But don't you have your wife to live for? Isn't that this whole thing? There was just a weird...
Yeah.
When you're watching it unfold, it all, you're like, oh, totally makes sense. Twist, cool, I'll keep going. And then when you think about it in retrospect, you're like, well, what?
Wait a second.
Isn't he desperate to go save his wife on the off chance that the Dominion are going to, like, you know, blow up wherever she is? It just seemed like his character didn't quite click into place for me.
Yes, and the point we find out later is that the message is from his wife. Mm-hmm. We don't know that, right? So that makes it seem all the more important, one would think, for Eddington to live and to save everybody. But he is seemingly very eager to die.
Yeah.
And I guess they kind of set that up because Sisko is talking to Eddington earlier and Eddington's like, I was the best leader that the Dominion ever had. And Sisko says, well, you always just wanted to be, you know, you wanted to trade in your gold uniform and be an action hero, basically. Mm-hmm. And so you're living out this little fantasy without you actually thinking about how it's impacting the rest of the universe, right? And you killed everybody who died, basically, is your fault. And if these missiles hit Cardassia, he doesn't actually say this. Well, he does say that the war would be Eddington's fault, but he also should probably, I would have pointed out that like billions and billions of people will die because of your refusal to help. And it will all be your fault, which they don't really hammer home too much, but they kind of get there in the end. And that kind of paints Eddington as this. Eddington doesn't come out as a great character in this episode. He's basically selfish, right? Because he wants to die in a blaze of glory, hence the title. And he doesn't really care that he's leaving his wife behind. He thinks that I've saved her, and so I will be remembered. Well, this is me projecting, but it seems like he's thinking, well, I will save her and trade her my life for hers, and then she'll be eternally grateful, and then I will get to die a hero.
It's interesting. It doesn't quite, I don't know, it doesn't quite track for me, and I can't quite tell, because I found him a relatively, an interesting character, but sort of an unsympathetic one, but then the final scene with Sisko and Dax, it seemed like we were supposed to think, like, oh, now Sisko is a little more on his side, and I'm not sure that fully tracked. I also just think there's little things in execution, like, so we get the point where Eddington and Sisko are in battle, and Eddington gets shot, and he's like, oh, like, I'm so injured that I can't keep going, and so you should go without me. But the way that they, it doesn't look like he's injured in such a critical way, so it kind of seems like he got, like, a paper cut and was like, I've got to die in battle now. And I don't know if I was supposed to be like, oh, he's over-exaggerating, or if I was supposed to be like, oh, he's so noble for a sec. It was all unclear to me in not a, like, a cool ambiguous way, and mostly just a confusing ambiguous way.
Yes, like, why does he have to stay there? And he delays them for, like, 2 seconds.
Are you just going, like, 3 feet down the corridor? Right. Like, I don't understand. Just carry him. There were little logistical things like that that confused me.
And there were a lot of Maquis in that room. They could have come, a couple of guys and his wife could have come back, and that would have been 4 people. Sisko, yeah,
and
three Sisko other
comes
people.
Down and he's like, Rebecca's like, where? The wife's like, where is he? And he's like, oh, he's gone. No questions. Let's just leave. I don't know. And I did really like a lot of this in concept. I like that idea of sort of, you have two men who are super principled, but also potentially driven equally by ego. So it's like, where does the, where do your principles match up with sort of your personal glory stuff? So that's all interesting. It was just something about this just didn't quite work. I don't want to just blame it on the performer. But I was like, if this was a Sisko and a Gul Dukat episode, like episode would have been amazing. But there was something like Eddington is no Gul Dukat, which is a high bar. But there was just something. If he had just been a little bit more interesting, I think it would have been like an A plus in my book.
I agree. Eddington is the weakest point of this. I don't know. Well, plus I think that the writers also really didn't know what to do with this character. And so it's an interesting, like you said, all of the things that they make him do are interesting in concept. But when you watch it, it's kind of like, I don't understand why you're doing this. And why are you so angry? Why are you obsessed with fresh tomatoes? Yeah. I don't get it.
And Canadian coins. Oh, yes. Lucky Looney. That was so, that was a great random detail, but I was like, wow, they really just picked out of a hat for what his little,
what is
the little beloved thing would be.
And for a second there, I had seen this episode years and years ago, so I don't remember much of it. I thought, oh, the codes for the missiles, which at this point we still think are true, are real things, are like engraved on his coin or something.
Oh,
and they're
going
to have to go get that coin, right? But no, it's just a random detail that he shares that he, after he kills Sisko, he's going to go get his lucky coin, which it seems unclear to me if he went back to Deep Space Nine after killing Sisko. I believe he just would have been arrested.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like, well, okay, you know, you won, so here's all your stuff that I can go have a good life.
Just keep that ship you're on.
I was sort of thinking, not to just rewrite the episode, but I was sort of wishing that, you know, when they're talking about the tomatoes and they're talking about the coin, maybe they could have been talking about Eddington's wife and maybe he had pretended like she had died or something. And so then when we get the reunion, we're like, oh my God, she's still alive. And this is so much more meaningful. But it felt, again, like the coin's a random detail, the tomatoes are a random detail, the wife's a random detail, and they're all okay, but they just don't quite add up compared to somebody like Sisko, who, I mean, obviously we've had so much more time with him, and he's actually a main character, but I think that this is a really great Sisko episode, and I love that scene that you mentioned where he just pulls, like, the craziest power move, which is that, oh, we're about to blow up, and I'm going to go get coffee while I leave. I was like, damn, Sisko, that was bold, and it was such a Sisko thing. I really couldn't imagine any of the other captains doing that. It was such like a prime example of sort of the way Sisko operates, and I thought that was by far the best scene in the episode.
And the thing I think that makes it work so well for me for Sisko is that he tells Eddington exactly what he's doing. Mm-hmm. He's like, I know you want me to think you have this death wish, but I don't think you do. And then he walks away. I can see Captain Kirk doing the same kind of ruse, but he totally wouldn't. We wouldn't get that next level of, I'm going to tell you what I am doing. It would be, you know, oh, Captain Kirk is so clever and he has this elaborate ruse. Whereas Captain Sisko's like, no, this is what I'm doing, and I am sure, I'm so sure I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to go get my coffee.
Oh, it was so good. It was just a great, Avery Brooks is just so great, and just, like, a little bit out there in the right way. And maybe that's it, too. Like, they're two, both of these actors who spend most of the episode together, they're a little bit, like, off-kilter in their performances, and maybe they don't quite complement each other the way, like, I think because Gul Dukat is so put together, he sort of butts heads really well with Sisko. But when you put these two sort of like very theatrical people together, their conversations are not quite as interesting to me.
Yes. And so Avery Brooks makes, I mean, not that I'm an acting expert, right? But he makes so many interesting choices, right? He has some odd pauses and he looks places where you wouldn't think he should be looking at that time. And it's especially clear in this episode because there's so much one-on-one with him and Eddington where you just get, it's kind of like, it throws you off because it's not what you're expecting him to do. But it works well. But then I think you're right. Eddington also is kind of this weird character that doesn't make much sense and you don't know what's going on with him. So you get them both in the same little shuttle and it's overload.
A quirk fest.
Exactly. And then luckily Quark wasn't on there because then forget about it. What would have
been all over the place.
That's right. So what do you think of this episode overall?
I do like it. I think that it's sort of a noble failure and that it's trying to do something really cool and you can see the beats of it and you can really appreciate them. The execution's a little bit off for me, but this is certainly more engaging than an episode that just has, like, nothing interesting to say at all, even if that's well executed. Like, I'd probably rather watch this episode. So it doesn't rise up to being, like, an A+ episode for me. It's probably more in, like, the B+ range, but I do appreciate that it's sort of trying to make this world more complex, and I think it's sort of a good example of all the stuff that DS9 does with all the serialization, and we're embracing that sort of moral gray area. So yeah, I like it more in concept than I do in execution.
Yes, and I think it's a good, if you're looking for, it's a basically as much of a later season Deep Space Nine episode, standalone episode, as you can get.
Yeah.
So you need to know some stuff, but even if you don't know any of it, you can still watch this, which I feel like is not the case for a lot of season 6 and 7 episodes.
Yeah, definitely.
So this is a good, if you're DS9 curious, this isn't like the best DS9 episode, but the problem with many of the best DS9 episodes is you need to know like 800 other things about it. So this is, I think, a good sample, certainly a good example of Cisco. Definitely. So, you know, worth watching just for that.
Yeah. And it's just a good, like you said, it's a good example of sort of all the hallmarks of a DS9 episode. And even if they aren't quite arranged in the perfect way, it is a really cool way. Oh, okay. So these are all the different topics that the show touches on.
And you get to visit the characters, so you get a little sense of the other characters as well, even though they really don't do anything. But at least you get a sense of them. So, yeah, I would think that this might be a good, like, I want to see what this Deep Space Nine is about. Maybe I'll watch this episode.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, Caroline, thank you so much. Caroline. Oh, I did it again. Caroline, thank you. I even have a note. That's how bad I am.
It's okay. I put it in your head, and then, you know, when you're doing that thing, and you're like, don't say this, don't say this, exactly. No matter what you say, yeah.
It is horrible, but I thank you so much for joining me and for putting up with my craziness.
This is a lot. I will talk DS9 any day of the week.
Well, I'll have you back on if I haven't scarred you emotionally.
Oh, I'm ready for it.